This message is not so much an exclusive Bible study, but it's got some current events in it too. Memorial stones. Let's stand for our scripture reading. Joshua 4, first three verses. As soon as the entire nation had completed its crossing of the Jordan, the Lord spoke to Joshua. He said, "Gather together 12 men from the people, one man from each tribe, and tell them, 'Pick up 12 stones from the middle of the Jordan where the priests' feet were standing. Bring them along with you and put them down where you camp tonight.'" You may be seated. It is a new year. January and February have special significance, so I thought of memorials. I need not mention what February is about. Besides the Dresden Holocaust against Germany on 13-14 February 1945, January is often referred to as General's Month, since no less than four famous Confederate generals claimed January as their birth month. James Longstreet, January 8, 1821, Robert E. Lee, January 19, 1807, Thomas Jonathan Stonewall Jackson, January 21, 1824, and George Pickett, January 28, 1825. It is ironic that MLK Day sits between two of these birthdays, Lee and Jackson. Lee Jackson Day was a state holiday in Virginia begun in 1889. Its observation was eliminated in 2020, replaced by Election Day as a state holiday. Confederate History Month, begun in 1994, happens to be in April because the Confederate Memorial Day falls during this month. It has been observed by seven southern states. Of course, we realize that all Confederate memorials have been under attack and nearly all of them removed. The Robert E. Lee Monument in Richmond, Virginia, was the first installation on Monument Avenue in 1890 and would ultimately be the last monument removed from that site. The statue was taken down on September 8, 2021, then sent to storage. Now that the Confederate flag has all been outlawed as a symbol of racist hate, guess what the next step is? Yes, going after the Stars and Stripes. An apartment complex in Oregon actually sent a letter to residents saying that anyone who displayed an American flag sticker on their vehicle would have to remove it or face eviction because a lot of non-whites live in the complex. Then there's a white woman in Texas with a daughter serving in Iraq who had to remove the American flag in her office because an African immigrant found it offensive. We often hear of so-called conservatives on radio or TV brag about being colorblind and praising MLK and the civil rights laws of the 1960s, which happened to be the very cause of many serious problems they claim to be troubled by. James Edwards wrote about this recently, saying, and I'm quoting, "Earlier this summer, I attended the big annual convention known as Freedom Fest. Freedom Fest has a conservative libertarian emphasis. At Freedom Fest, we envision a world where every person experiences maximum liberty in every aspect of their lives," end quote, their official website states. Yet at this event, supposedly devoted to creating a world where every person has maximum liberty, one speaker after another beamed as they quoted MLK, holding him up as a paragon of freedom and liberty. The notion of people who are supposedly committed to creating maximum liberty praising MLK is simply too bizarre for words. Hearing it myself repeated over the course of a few days had me feeling as if I was in an episode of The Twilight Zone. Do 4th of July parades feature tributes to Benedict Arnold? Do animal rights activists declare their love for Colonel Sanders? Do the people of Nagasaki and Hiroshima constantly tell us how much they admire Harry Truman? None of those scenarios would be crazier than conservatives praising MLK. Conservatives want maximum liberty? Well, here are just a few of the liberties that MLK and his civil rights movement destroyed: freedom of association, freedom of contract, freedom of religion, freedom from crime, freedom to live around people we want to live around, freedom to do business with people we want to do business with, the freedom of states to set qualifications for voting and to define what qualifies as a lawful marriage, the freedom to give our kids a good education in safe schools, and so much more. When MLK was alive, no conservative supported him or his movement. In fact, opposition to the civil rights movement was one of the hallmarks of conservatism. It was an essential position. Many great Southern Democrats, such as Lester Maddox, said that if the civil rights movement succeeded, the Christian way of life in America was finished. These men were prophets, and nearly everything they predicted has come true. But I'm not sure that even they could have foreseen that in just a few decades, people calling themselves conservatives would be praising the man who deconstructed America. So ends the Edwards quote. Now I have an article here by Reverend Bette McAtee, The Placing of Robert E. Lee in Hell, a Cultural Analysis. He starts off with two quotes here, from one from our enemy and then one from a patriot. The task of history, therefore, once the world beyond the truth has disappeared, is to establish the truth of this world. That's Karl Marx. Quote, the march of providence is so slow and our desires so impatient, the work of progress is so immense and our means of aiding it so feeble, the life of humanity is so long, that of the individual so brief, that we often see only the ebb of the advancing wave and are thus discouraged. It is history that teaches us to hope. End quote from Robert E. Lee. In the last week, a statue of Robert E. Lee on his horse Traveler was melted in effigy in a fiery furnace heated, we are told, to 2,250 degrees Fahrenheit. This was something that could have been done quite apart from the fanfare and hoopla, as the enemies of Lee and what he symbolizes had already achieved victory years prior with the removal of the Lee statue from the public square in Charlottesville, Virginia. However, old feuds run deep, and the descendants of the victors in the War of Northern Aggression were compelled by their hatred to add insult to injury. Thus, one of the communiques of the Marxist left, which happens to be the Washington Post, felt it necessary to rub large amounts of salt in a very old wound by placing a photo of Lee burning in a hell-like furnace. This was the Jacobin left gleefully rubbing the noses of heritage Americans in Jacobin triumph and our defeat. My immediate thought upon seeing the photo and reading the article was, quote, and this is what they wish they could do with all of us who find this action a testimony to vile Marxist revolutionary behavior, end quote. In this smelting of Lee, we see once again the Marxist disciples reaching to accomplish what Marx spoke of in our lead-in quote. The left is working on the task and has been working on that task since its inception in Genesis 3, of scrubbing away the world beyond the truth so as to establish their truth of this world. The melting of Lee is not merely an attack on heritage Americans. It is an attack on the biblical metaphysics that gives meaning to reality in favor of a humanist epistemology, wherein history and Marxist historians are given the task of establishing truth in this world. They have been at this task in regards to General Lee at every turn. Consider that in 2021, the Cathedral of the Rockies finished replacing a stained glass window pane that the church felt was racist and non-inclusive. The offending window featured Robert E. Lee standing shoulder to shoulder with Washington and Lincoln. Lee was changed out here for the first black female bishop in Methodism, with ties to Boise. Lee was probably pleased to be finally removed from the same window pane as Lincoln. Also in 2021, Robert E. Lee IV, a descendant of the general, made some minor headlines when he denounced his forefather by offering to whatever microphone he could find that, quote, "We have made my ancestor an idol of white supremacy, racism, and hate," end quote. One wonders who the "we" is that Robert E. G. Lee IV is referring to. This same descendant was quoted in 2016 in the Washington Post, quote, "of the shame he felt over his great-great-great-great uncle's legacy," end quote. A great irony in all this is that Lee himself was relieved that slavery had ended. The man, if we are to take him at his own word seriously, was pleased at its end. Quote, "I am rejoiced that slavery is abolished. I believe it will be greatly for the interests of the South. So fully am I satisfied of this as regards Virginia especially, that I would cheerfully have lost all I have lost by the war, and have suffered all I have suffered to have this object attained," end quote. However, to the Marxists, this is irrelevant. History will be what they and their historians say it is, and may the truth that is beyond this world be damned. In all this, we need to keep in mind that Robert E. Lee is not the only one who is being tossed upon the bonfires of vanity, either by way of removal, destruction, or defacing. The symbols of Western civilization and American history are everywhere being cast aside. Everyone from Major General Philip Schuyler of the American War of Independence fame, to U.S. Grant, to Christopher Columbus, to George Washington, to Juan Ponce de Leon, to abolitionists Matthias Baldwin and John Greenleaf Whittier, at this point, it is past obvious that this is not merely an attack on the Old South, but a revolt against every semblance of civilization and order that has any whiff of Christianity in favor of the anarchy of old chaos and dark night. Anybody who is familiar with the nature of revolution understands that once the revolutionary mindset gets rolling, eventually the revolution eats its own. The revolutionaries started with the statues raised to the honored Confederate dead, but the frenzy extends now even to 19th century abolitionists who may have been animated in their opposition to slavery due to their Christian principles. Also, let's not miss here that all the statues have one other thing in common. All the symbols of the West being pulled down are of white people. For those with eyes to see, all this statuary removal is clearly a concrete expression of the desire to rid the West of the white man. The irony here is that a great percentage of those pulling down the statuary are white people who don't realize that soon enough the revolution will also throw them on the bonfires, regardless of how many white statues they helped pull down. Those who are aware of the way worldview warfare works understand that this current phenomenon of pillorying the statues of our heroes is in no way something new. If one looks at the era of the Reformation, one finds the reformers tearing down Roman Catholic statuary left and right. If one looks at the era of the rise of the revolution in France or the Bolshevik Revolution, one finds statues and symbols being pulled down. Even in the war against Iraq, one of the streaming images instantly broadcast was of an American tank pulling down a statue of Saddam Hussein. One way a person can know that there is worldview change in the air is by seeing what we are seeing now, the assault on the symbols of the people who are being replaced. This brings us to the observation of George Orwell. Quote, "The most effective way to destroy people is to deny and obliterate their own understanding of their history." End quote. The attack on General Lee, as well as the pulling down of the symbols of the Christian West, is approximately in the service of destroying the Christian white man. Behind that is the ultimate purpose of stripping from Jesus Christ the title King of Kings and Lord of Lords. End quote. The Marxist mob hates Christ, and because they hate Christ, they hate the Christian white man who has been, in God's providence, the carrier of Christian civilization, and so the fragrance of Christ. That fragrance is deeply hated by the left, and so they cast us all in hell by snapping a photo of Lee's face as red hot and molten. There is very little more that these Marxist demons could do to inform us that they intend to wipe out anybody who opposes the revolution. In one respect, this mockery of Lee, Christianity, and Jesus Christ is a good thing. It is good because it draws a bright line between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. This kind of thing establishes the antithesis between those who are of their father the devil and those on the Lord's side. We are approaching a crescendo on this matter. Pat Buchanan summarized this nicely a few years ago. Quote, "In half a lifetime, many Americans have seen their God dethroned, their heroes defiled, their culture polluted, their values assaulted, their country invaded, and themselves demonized as extremists and bigots for holding on to beliefs Americans have held for generations." End quote. When the crescendo finally arrives, you can be sure that just as during previous historical crescendos on this count, there will be blood in the streets. Just as there was blood in the streets in Paris in 1789, in the streets of Harper's Ferry in 1860, in the streets of Moscow in 1918, in the streets of Budapest in 1919, in the streets of Peking in 1949, and in the streets of Havana in 1956. Whenever these Christ haters are able to expand their revolutionary mindset, the blood begins to flow by the gallon. For those with their ears close to the ground, none of this is surprising in the least. With the success of the civil rights movement, animated and financed as it was by the Communist International, the handwriting was on the wall. Then in the 1980s, when the Marxist Martin Luther King was officially placed in our pantheon of heroes, it was only a matter of time till American heroes, who stood for the principles exactly opposite of those of King, would be pushed out of our pantheon of heroes. King is taken out of the closet and is replaced in the closet by Lee, Jackson, Washington, Jefferson, etc. So, the Jacobin War of Northern aggression continues apace. It never really ended, and it will not end until Christianity and the white man is wiped out and incinerated in just the same way that one of the greatest Americans of our history was incinerated. In the end, this casting of General Robert E. Lee into hell was a testimony to the greatness of the man. The man was so great, such a Christian hero, that he now is, to the left, the embodiment of the Christian white man. It is my prayer that those responsible for this desecration of Robert E. Lee, for this further cynical attack on biblical Christianity, for this further attempt to snuff out the lordship of Jesus Christ, will result in an eternity of their seeing that red and molten image of Lee ever before them. Sic semper tyrannis, that means thus always to tyrants, the state motto of Virginia. So ends the article by Reverend McAtee. Genesis 28:18, and Jacob rose up early in the morning and took the stone that he had put for his pillows and set it up for a pillar and poured oil upon the top of it, end quote. This was Jacob's pillar stone at Luz, renamed Bethel. Now it is in Scotland. Genesis 31:45, and Jacob took a stone and set it up for a pillar, end quote, on the occasion of the covenant between Jacob and Laban. Genesis 35:14, and Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him, even a pillar of stone, and he poured a drink offering thereon, and he poured oil thereon, end quote. And this is where God spoke to Jacob at Bethel. 1 Samuel 7:12, then Samuel took a stone and set it between Mizpah and Shen, and called the name of it Ebenezer, saying, hitherto hath the Lord helped us. This was God's intervention in a battle. Nearly every nation has adopted this method. The Egyptian obelisks, megalithic monuments of the Celts, Stonehenge and the Avebury in England, stones that are supposed by some to be not temples nor burial places, but memorials of some battle or event. The opening text tells us of God's directions to Joshua to set a memorial after Israel had crossed the Jordan River. We read from the previous chapter, that's chapter 3, what has already taken place. Quote, so the people set out from their tents to cross the Jordan River, with the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant in full view of the people. When the priests who carried the Ark entered the Jordan River, as their feet touched the water's edge, the Jordan River overflows all of its banks daily during the harvest season. The water flowing downstream from above stood still in a single location, a great distance away at Adam, a city near Zarethan. The water that flowed south toward the sea in the Arabah, that is, the Dead Sea, was completely cut off. So the people crossed opposite Jericho. The priests who were carrying the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the middle of the Jordan River, while all Israel crossed on dry ground until the entire nation had finished crossing the Jordan River. End quote from Joshua 3:14-17, International Standard Version. This puts you in mind of the crossing of the Red Sea when they left Egypt, doesn't it? At least it does me. Is it not interesting that the waters backed up as far as the city of Adam? What a coincidence, or is it? I think there's a spiritual application here. That is, God provided a salvation that goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden, where Adam failed, resulting in the fall of Adamkind. As the previous generation who crossed the Red Sea, now some 40 years later, the presence of God was there to stay the water so Israel could pass through the other side. The priests stood still and allowed the entire nation to pass before they continued out as well. What a memorable event. We continue reading from chapter 4. And he, that's Joshua, said to them, go over before the ark of the Lord, your God, into the middle of Jordan, and let every one of you take up a stone on his back, one for every tribe of the children of Israel. so that this may be a sign among you when your children say to you in the time to come, 'What is the reason for these stones?' Then you will say to them, 'Because the waters of Jordan were cut off before the ark of the Lord's agreement, when it went over Jordan, the waters of Jordan were cut off.' And these stones will be a sign for the children of Israel, keeping it in their memory forever." Joshua 4:5-7. A memorial is to remind us of the provision of our God, including our forefathers who have preceded us in the faith. These 12 stones, one representing each of the tribes, we see that in Joshua 4:4, were erected in Gilgal, mentioned in verse 19. They gave fathers the opportunity to tell their children of the miraculous passage of the nation of Israel and the Ark of the Covenant across the flooded river. The unity of the 12 tribes was to be preserved in this memorial. The very river which should afterwards separate the eastern tribes from the western furnished from its bed the materials for a memorial which should bind Israel together in the memory of a common mercy to all its families. 12 other stones were placed in the riverbed and would be visible when the waters were low. That would be not during the flood season, of course. Joshua 4:9. And Joshua set up 12 stones in the midst of Jordan, in the place where the feet of the priests which bear the Ark of the Covenant stood. These stones were set up where the priests bearing the Ark stood, while the others were set up where the Israelites rested for the night, and that was in Gilgal. It has been asked why stones should be placed as a memorial in the Jordan itself, where no man could see them. The answer is simple. They were not placed in the center of Jordan, but at some distance from its banks. They were placed where the priest stood, that is, at the brink of the Jordan, which at that time had overflowed its banks, according to Joshua 3:15, and so much larger. The river was just so much wider than it originally and normally is. Joshua 4:10, "For the priests which bear the ark stood in the midst of Jordan, until everything was finished that the Lord commanded Joshua to speak unto the people, according to all that Moses commanded Joshua, and the people hasted and passed over." Then, when all had safely crossed, the ark of God was borne across the bed of the river, and as soon as the feet of the priests touched the highest point that the waters had reached on the other side, they returned to their place, and all was as it had been before. No wonder the Israelites erected a double memorial of a scene so glorious as this. It is said that this stone memorial within the banks of Jordan were the same stones that John the Baptist referred to when he said, quote, "Bring forth therefore fruits worthy of repentance, and begin not to say within yourselves, 'We have Abraham to our father,' for I say unto you that God is able of these stones to raise up children unto Abraham." That's found in Luke 3:8. 1 Peter 2:5, "Ye also, as lively stones, are built up a spiritual house and holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God by Jesus Christ." Amen.